This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It has already been given to five individuals who were infected with Ebola.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci of the U.S. National Institute of Health talking about a new Ebola treatment drug being used in the DRC. Details next. Also, a 35-year-old woman born in Somalia is one step away from becoming the first African refugee elected to the U.S. Congress. And two top-ranking Kenyan officials, previously thought untouchable, have been charged with corruption. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Medical officials are trying out a new treatment drug for an outbreak of the deadliest strain of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. If it helps people who have contracted the highly contagious virus, it could become a key tool in containing Ebola. A vaccine was used to prevent infection in those who were exposed to it in the last outbreak a few months ago. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the U.S. National Institutes of Health has been involved in developing both drugs. VOA's Paul Alexander spoke with him about the treatment.
The intervention in question is called monoclonal antibody 114, and it is a treatment, not a vaccine. It's a treatment that is a monoclonal antibody that was derived and developed from a patient from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, back in the 1995 Kikwit outbreak in the DRC. An individual was infected, recovered from the infection, and we brought the person back to the United States to draw their blood and try and clone the B cells that make the antibodies that this person had produced in his body to then essentially clear his virus and hopefully protect him against any future exposure. So we developed this monoclonal antibody here, and we have done a number of tests in an animal model and have shown that when you infect an animal up to 5 days after they've become infected and you passively transfer this antibody, that you can actually protect the animals from getting sick and they recover. So the next thing to do would be to do a phase one trial in humans to determine if it's safe to use in humans. And we are doing that and just essentially finishing it up with three separate doses, 5 milligrams, 25 milligrams, and 50 milligrams, in normal human volunteers here in the NIH community hospital, in the hospital that we have within the Washington, D.C., Maryland community. And now the antibody has been shipped to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and as the WHO reported, it has already been given to five individuals who were infected with Ebola. We cannot say whether it has shown any benefit because we don't have anything to compare it with because it's being given as a compassionate use. So it is still an experimental therapy, but it is being used in this manner.
So when would you use this as opposed to the vaccine?
Well, the vaccine is used to prevent Ebola infection. This is used to give treatment to someone who's already infected. We can say it's safe because we've learned from our phase one study that there has been really uneventful and safe. It also has the advantage in that it's made in a lyophilized fashion, which means that it doesn't require the strict cold chain temperatures that you generally need when you ship interventions to countries that don't have good electricity to keep it well frozen below a certain level. Since it's lyophilized, which is namely freeze-dried, you can merely reconstitute it by the normal liquids, saline and others that you reconstitute this with.
Is it like the vaccine in that it's specific to one strain?
It is specific to the Zaire strain, which is the current strain that is currently in Democratic Republic of the Congo.
I recall that you talked about the possibility of getting this into the last outbreak. That did not come through?
Well, the outbreak essentially contained itself by public health measures, so there was no need to use it. But since we were in the process of working with them and we completed our phase one trial here, not completed, but we were well into our phase one trial here in the United States, they requested that we send it to them, and they then went ahead and used it.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci of the U.S. National Institute of Health. He was speaking to VOA's Paul Alexander. Mali officials have delayed announcing the results of Sunday's runoff presidential election until tomorrow. The results were to have been announced today around 5 p.m. in Bamako. The government said the delay would allow time for certified results to arrive from three remote locations. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita already has claimed victory and is expected to win a second term when official results come out. He faced Somalia Cisse in a runoff for the second straight election. Cisse has claimed fraud in the election and plans to challenge the results. Turnout was estimated at just 22%, roughly half the total for the first round 2 weeks ago. Although thousands of troops provided security, officials say threats from Islamic militants kept hundreds of polling stations from opening. One electoral officer was shot dead in the far north. Still, international monitors say the voting was mostly peaceful and they saw no signs of widespread fraud. The International Organization for Migration says the number of African migrants coming to Spain is rising, while the number coming to Italy is falling. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The IOM says 47,000 irregular migrants have entered Spain using the Western Mediterranean over the past 2 years, a huge increase from the steady trickle taking that route in previous decades. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the nationalities of the migrants arriving in Spain mirror those that used to leave Libya for Italy. He tells VOA migrants from Guinea, Gambia, Mali, Senegal, and Ivory Coast appear to have changed the route they traditionally followed to reach European shores.
It indicates that probably West African migrants who were using the Sahara route up through Agadez into Tripoli have realized that the expense, the danger, the risk, and then what happens to them in Libya all combined to make that a less attractive route than what had been an older route up along the coast into Morocco. So they seem to be returning to that route.
Libya has seen a virtual flood of refugees and migrants in the past half decade. But human rights groups say tens of thousands have fallen victim to abuse, torture, kidnappings for ransom, and exploitation by smugglers, traffickers, and organized crime syndicates. The IOM says 25,000 migrants have arrived in Spain this year, compared to 19,200 arrivals in Italy. While that is a large number for Spain, Millman says Italy used to receive that number of arrivals every month during the peak migration years of 2014 and 2015. IOM data also show that two-thirds of the nearly 1,500 migrant deaths in the Mediterranean this year have happened on the route to Italy. Millman says no one is sure why deaths on the route to Spain is so low, but speculates that people in Spain are on the lookout for incoming boats and may be responding faster and better to those that appear to be in trouble. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Zimbabwe, the ruling ZANU-PF party has filed a petition in the Constitutional Court challenging the opposition's bid to overturn the results of last month's presidential polls. The July 30th elections were won by current president Emmerson Mnangagwa. Last week, the opposition movement for Democratic Change Alliance, led by Nelson Chamisa, provided documents to the court that dispute the decision of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. The opposition party says it has evidence of electoral tampering and the manipulation of figures. However, a rival faction of the MDC, led by former presidential candidate Kozani Kupe, is endorsing the election outcome. VOA correspondent Adi Gondo has the story.
Presidential candidate and leader of the MDC faction led by Tokozani Kupe is now one of the 24 respondents named in the MDC Alliance's court challenge. She publicly declared the polls to have been free and fair. Some political analysts attribute Kupe's move to myopia and perhaps a need to settle the score with their former party rivals in the main opposition, MDC. Political analyst Thomas Stolle weighs in on the matter.
I think Kupe is only focusing on her party, that is MDCT, but not looking at the broader outcome of the elections. And obviously, as someone who has cut ties with Chamisa, I feel she's not interested to look at the issues that have been brought to the table, which evidence is glaring regarding the irregularities that are there. I think it was too quick for her really to endorse the election without looking at the evidence that has been, I think, brought forward by Chamisa and other colleagues who feel that there were irregularities. And that evidence, obviously, should be looked at by all stakeholders.
Sithole elaborated on what he considers an example of the election anomalies that challenge Kupe's decision.
Yeah, because in some instances, looking at the evidence that the MDC Alliance has brought forward, you find that you have more numbers of people who voted in some polling stations more than the original number of registered voters in those particular polling stations. Obviously, these discrepancies cannot be ignored. And for a political player who participated in the election as a presidential candidate, it would be really sad if she had to ignore this kind of evidence.
Presidential candidates and voters have a stake in the outcome of the polls. Still, some analysts support Kupe's decision to endorse the elections, given her disputes with the internal leadership of the MDC. Analyst Tapfuma Machakaire shares his views on the subject.
It's her democratic right to spell out her position with regards to the outcome of the elections. But however, if you look at the logic of what transpired after the death of Morgan Tsvangirai, logic will then tell you that she would not have gone with Chamisa, who is the person, Chamisa's faction of the party, which is fighting, which is taking this issue to court. And in terms of credibility within or among her supporters and Zimbabweans at large, it depends on where one stands. Because some really believe that Mnangagwa is the winner of this election, or others believe the courts should make a decision. So Zimbabweans will make a judgment on her pronouncement, and obviously others will not be happy. They would have wished that all opposition forces unite against the so-called or alleged electoral fraud. So Zimbabweans are now unsure of where to place her in terms of the decision that she has taken.
Observers say Zimbabwean political culture may need to shift gears and move beyond personality politics. It does seem that personality clashes often take precedence over principles upon which parties can forge sustainable development agendas. For now, Zimbabwe and the rest of the world wait for the country's highest court to confirm or reject the results of the contested polls. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Nineteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A 35-year-old woman born in Somalia is one step away from becoming the first African refugee elected to the U.S. Congress. Ilhan Omar won the primary election Tuesday for the Democratic Party's candidate to represent Minnesota's 5th District. She's likely to beat her Republican opponent in November because the district has heavily favors Democrats. Omar earlier won a seat in the State House of Representatives in Minnesota, which is home to the largest number of Somali refugees in the United States. She vividly recalls being a struggling 8-year-old in a refugee camp in Kenya, but she also understands the challenges that many face in the United States. She has described herself as a millennial with student debt. If she wins, she will become the second Muslim woman in Congress. She wears a hijab. This week in Kenya, two top-ranking officials previously thought untouchable were charged with corruption in a $3 billion Chinese-built railway project. The high-profile prosecutions are part of President Uhuru Kenyatta's efforts to show no official is out of reach in Kenya's war on graft. But some analysts question if the charges will actually lead to convictions and a lasting legacy for Kenyatta, or if they are simply political theater. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
Kenya Railways Managing Director Atenas Maina and Lands Commission Chairman Mohamed Swazuri are accused of overseeing $2 million in fraudulent compensation payments. More than a dozen other Kenyan officials and business people are also facing charges related to illegally buying and selling off state corporations' land. While they deny the charges, the arrests are hailed in Kenya as a rare crackdown on top-level corruption. But political analyst Linda Olo says the prosecutions are less about systemic change and more about President Uhuru Kenyatta.
Uhuru is more concerned of his legacy. How will history judge him after his presidency? So that is why he's trying to play the good man syndrome right now by doing things that will appeal to the general public. What he's doing is mostly for his image after office.
In June, Kenyatta announced all public servants would undergo a compulsory lifestyle audit to account for the sources of their income and assets. But it's not all political theater. Kenyatta and Swiss President Alain Berset signed an agreement aimed at helping Kenya recover corrupt assets stashed by Kenyan officials in Swiss banks. Kenyatta's Director of Public Prosecutions has also arrested top officials at Kenya National Youth Service, electric power provider, and more than a dozen firms accused of benefiting from illegal tenders and misappropriated funds. Kenyatta on Sunday declared his determination to win the war on graft, even if he has to go after those close to himself.
Over the last few weeks, I've lost very many friends, Bishop. Because I've been receiving so many calls that, you know, how can you just sit there and watch all this destruction going on? You must stop it. And I said, well, it's difficult to stop. It's difficult to stop not because we love to destroy, but because we must fight impunity.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga last year accused the president of diverting the railway to benefit the Kenyatta family. Odinga seized his criticism in April after making a deal with Kenyatta to work together. In June, a Kenyan lawmaker linked Kenyatta's young brother Muhoho to the importation of contraband sugar. In response, President Kenyatta said if there is evidence, his brother should be investigated and prosecuted. But going after a sitting president's family is unlikely in Kenya, and the National Lands Accord Movement's David Kimanzi doubts top officials will be among those punished.
There has not been a single conviction, you know, of a person who has looted the public or from the public coffers. Every person now is looking for how it is going to be their turn to eat.
Despite this week's high-level arrests, there are still officials who are untouchable, says Kimanzi. If you touch them, he says, you touch the very core of the government. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
One of the most divisive debates in South Africa is how to fast-track land ownership. Most land is still owned by white people. The governing African National Congress has committed to what it calls land expropriation without compensation in a bid to create more black landowners. The government is taking input on the contentious issue. From Johannesburg, Nadia Same explains.
South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white, and the land shall be shared amongst those who work it. These famous words are from South Africa's Freedom Charter, which the country's democracy is based on. But over two decades later, the land is still not being equitably shared, and most landowners are white. So the governing ANC says Section 25 of the Constitution must be amended to speed up the process. The Helen Suzman Foundation has made a submission to Parliament on the issue. Legal researcher at the Foundation, Mira Menal-Briel, does not believe constitutional change is needed.
Our solution for this is to recognize that Section 25 allows for expropriation without compensation, and then enact legislation that clearly defines the limits to that. And that will obviously also protect investment interests, or it won't discourage investment because the kind of element of certainty is taken care of.
Victor Khumuswana is an African politics analyst and author of Africa is Open for Business. He's looked at land reform issues around the continent and says the ANC should be very clear about its intentions.
I would say they must ask themselves why they need land reform. Do they need it? Do they want it to help people generate some livelihood? And are the people they are doing that for skilled or equipped with what it takes to use the land? Because land on its own means nothing.
Analysts say failure to put proper support and training structures in place for new landowners could severely hurt the economy. This was the case in 2000 when Zimbabwe's government seized the land of white farmers. That led to the collapse of the agriculture sector, hyperinflation, and shortages of essential food items. The country has still not recovered. Khumuswana says the issues there carry essential lessons.
The kind of land restitution that I've seen, which does not attach the restitution of the land to productive utilization, ends up just frustrating the economy. So if you're going to take land from A and give it to B, you better make sure that B will be able to maintain a certain level of productivity and utilization of that land. Otherwise, you might have just wasted your economic prospects.
President Cyril Ramaphosa announced last week that the ANC would pursue constitutional change to make land expropriation easier, even as countrywide hearings on citizens' views were still underway. Submissions to Parliament are also still being collated. Mira Menal-Briel outlines some of the Helen Suzman Foundation's recommendations.
Interestingly, South Africa has very poor statistics and data on who owns what land. So that would be one very preliminary recommendation, that the state do a very, very comprehensive audit, get a good picture of who owns what land and who needs land most and where. And with that comes a very necessary acknowledgement by the state of urbanization, because we have clearly established that there are a lot of people moving into cities, and that is where the need for secure tenure will be most in the next few years.
And then, of course, there is the matter of money.
As it stands in this year's budget, only 0.3% of our budget is dedicated to this. So obviously, without money, it's very hard to enforce kind of a framework as big as this would be.
Africa analyst Khumuswana says would-be landowners should ask themselves a few questions.
Are you going to farm? Are you going to produce? Are you going to exploit the minerals? And do you have the governance structures in place to make sure that whatever proceeds of the land ownership are distributed evenly among the people? Because if you don't, what you are doing to the landowners today will be done to you in no time.
When the ANC develops a concrete plan for land redistribution, opposition parties and civil society groups will pounce on any loose ends, as some are dead set against the idea of land changing hands in this way. For VOA, I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Fresh off a two-nation Africa visit to Zimbabwe and Malawi, Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered reporting on democracy in Africa. On the road with Shaka on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.